Welcome back to the deep dive. If you've ever felt like you're just spinning your wheels with English learning, maybe you've spent years, right, even got degrees, but you still feel like your English isn't quite sharp enough for work, or maybe you just can't pick up an English novel and actually enjoy it, then this deep dive is definitely for you.
That feeling, that frustration, it's almost universal for so many learners. And the sources we're looking at today, they really tackle this head on.
This core challenge.
Exactly. This realization that, wow, after all this time, my actual working vocabulary, my fluency, it's just not cutting it. So we're digging into a pretty radical system today. Think of it like a comprehensive game guide for really mastering English.
And the numbers behind this are quite something, aren't they? The sources point out this huge gap.
Yeah, it's
You've
massive.
got native speakers using, what, 20,000 to 30,000 words actively?
Right in that range.
But then many highly educated non-native speakers might only have around 5,000 words. They're trying to cross this huge chasm, not just a little gap.
It really boils down to efficiency, doesn't it? It's an efficiency problem.
Yeah.
And the methodology we're diving into comes from Wu Junyi, who founded Dynalysis English, and Liu Xiaoguang, who goes by Naiba.
Yokup.
And they basically distilled their own experiences. I mean, these guys went from failing basic tests to achieving really high levels. Gu Xiaoguang, for example, got over 1440 on the GRE
Wow.
and read like over 110 original English books. So they proved it's possible, but it demands a pretty radical shift.
Okay, let's get into that. What is the core sort of radical idea here?
The fundamental premise they put forward is this: English needs to stop being just a learning language for you.
Like a school subject.
Exactly. It has to become a working language, a tool you actually use day in, day out.
Yeah.
And our mission today, for you listening, is to unpack that system, give you the structure, that sort of mental hacks, and really the fast-track strategy to make that jump and get past those frustrating plateaus. So first things first, you kind of have to look at what's not working, right? And the big one they flag is what they call the accumulation attitude.
Yeah. The sort of drip feed approach. I think we've all done that. Learn a word here, a phrase there, hoping it'll all add up eventually. Like filling a pool with a teaspoon.
Exactly that analogy. They argue this low-intensity, super long-term method, it almost always tanks.
Why? Just lack of momentum.
Yeah, partly. It just can't sustain the motivation you need.
Yeah.
And the efficiency is honestly terrible. You learn 10 words, don't see them for months, poof, they're gone.
Right. Use it or lose it.
So this system, it demands a really intense, almost philosophical commitment. So like, either just drop English completely or commit fully to mastering it fast. Using focused time, you need to build real momentum.
That sounds pretty full on, but I guess it makes sense for skill building, like learning an instrument or coding. You need that initial deep dive, don't you?
You do. And Liu Xiaoguang, the co-author, he frames this really well with a gaming analogy. It provides a great mental model.
Okay, how does that work?
He basically says, think of learning English like a role-playing game. It's got levels, mandatory ones, your skills, listening, speaking, reading, writing, LSRW, those are your skill trees.
Ah.
You have to actively level them up. Your grammar is like your magic skill, vocabulary and pronunciation. Maybe that's your sword skill.
Yeah.
You got to grind.
And those big, scary standardized tests, TOEFL, GRE, or whatever system you're in.
Those are the boss battles, mandatory bosses you have to defeat to get to the next level in the game world. No way around them.
Right.
And the real killer, the pain point this system targets, is the platform period, the plateau.
Where you put in the effort, maybe loads of effort.
And nothing seems to happen. Your progress just stalls. And that's when most people give up.
Understandably.
So the dialysis method is meant to be like the cheat sheet, the outer hack, they call it, to power through those levels quickly so you see results and stay motivated.
Okay, so before we get into the how-to of dialysis, they say we need to ditch some common bad ideas first. Three big misconceptions.
Yeah, absolutely. Clear the decks. Misconception number one, the vocabulary focus.
Meaning just trying to memorize lists of words, buying those giant vocab books.
Exactly that. Or using flashcard apps religiously. They call this excruciatingly ineffective. Basically, a trap that kills motivation.
And I guess when you think about the sheer number of words, 20,000 to 30,000 for a native speaker trying to catch up 10 words a day.
It's mathematically hopeless. You'd spend decades and you'd forget faster than you learn.
Right.
Words need context. They're not just items on a list. Focusing only on lists means you die on the foundational step, as they put it. You need to see them, use them repeatedly in real situations. The dialysis method gives you a way to do that.
Okay, so ditch the list. What's misconception number two?
This is a big one. Rejecting grammar. You hear this a lot, right? Oh, grammar's useless, or it's all about feel or intuition.
Yeah, the immersion-only crowd sometimes pushes that.
And this system says absolutely not. I mean, look, if your goal is just basic survival phrases, coffee, please, maybe you can scrape by.
Sure, tourist English.
But if you want to operate professionally, read complex stuff like, you know, Jane Austen or The Economist, grammar is the absolute bedrock.
It's like the blueprint for complex thoughts, right?
It's the difference between a simple statement and a nuanced, multi-layered argument. That language sense people talk about. It's not magic. It comes from having grammar so deeply internalized you don't even think about it. Without it, complex writing is just gibberish, and your own output stays really basic.
Okay, essential. And the third misconception to abandon.
The obsession with having a pure accent. Trying to sound exactly like a specific type of native speaker, like received pronunciation or general American.
Yeah. Spending hours trying to get that perfect sound.
Right. They say this is a huge waste of energy, especially early on. The real focus needs to be on fluency and accuracy.
Meaning.
Can people understand you easily? Are you pronouncing individual sounds correctly? Is your intonation of the rise and fall natural? Are you connecting words smoothly, what linguists call liaison? Those are crucial.
Not necessarily sounding like you grew up in London.
Exactly. The sources point out loads of incredibly proficient non-native speakers, academics, broadcasters, even famous writers who have noticeable accents.
Huh?
But their command of the language, top-notch. Their ability to communicate complex stuff, excellent.
So chasing accent perfection distracts from the real work, getting lots of input, understanding the structure. Be clear, be accurate, don't worry about sounding native.
Precisely. Focus on comprehensibility and precision. Not mimicking an actor.
Okay, so we've dismantled the old ways, the slow accumulation, ignoring grammar, chasing accents. If that's out, what's in? Let's talk about the method itself, dialysis or tuashi.
Right. The name itself is key. It's borrowed from medicine, isn't it? Dialysis separates waste from blood using a filter.
A selective membrane.
That's the core metaphor. Imagine all of English, every book, every news article, that massive 100,000-word vocabulary is this huge ocean.
Okay.
All the words are dissolved in there. If you just dive in and try to grab everything, you'll drown. Information overload. Your brain just can't handle it.
So how does the dialysis part work? What's the filter?
Here's the genius twist. The filter isn't some special material. It's your electronic dictionary.
The dictionary is the filter. How?
The method reframes the dictionary. It's not just for looking things up. It's the mechanism you use to quantitatively precipitate, that's the term they use, or achu in Chinese. Only a very small, controlled number of new words into your active awareness, into your log.
Okay, so you look up a word, log it, but what about the filtering?
Here's the clever part. Because you're constantly reading, this process ensures that words you looked up before but maybe forgot, they naturally reappear in new contexts. This is the back osmosis, or kanai. The system forces repeated exposure in context.
Ah, so you're not studying lists. You're building vocabulary almost passively, driven by what you're actually reading. The system makes sure you see important words again and again.
Exactly. Without dedicated, painful vocab drills. Which leads us to the absolute cornerstone, the non-negotiable rule of this method, quantitative filtering. Discipline is everything here.
Right. This is the part that sounds tough. How strict is it?
It requires absolute adherence. For a physical book, like a standard paperback, you are allowed to look up only one word every two pages.
One word every two pages.
Yes. If you're reading on a screen, like an e-reader or tablet, it's one word per screen. And this is critical. Never look up words on two consecutive screens.
Wow. That feels incredibly restrictive. If I don't know five words on a page, I have to skip four of them.
You have to. Because the instant you start looking up everything, two bad things happen. First, your reading speed grinds to a halt. Total flow killer.
Yeah, I can see that.
Second, psychologically, you reinforce the feeling of I don't know enough, the feeling of failure. This strict limit forces you to prioritize reading momentum and overall volume above understanding every single word.
So the mantra is reading on is more important than studying words.
That's it. Exactly. Yeah. You have to trust the process. Trust that the context will give you enough to follow the gist, and trust that if a word is truly important, the dialysis system will bring it back to you later when you encounter it again.
So skipping words isn't failing the language. It's succeeding at the method by keeping the flow going. That's a big mental shift.
Huge shift. And this discipline system, It really relies on what they call hardware acceleration. Basically, ditch the paper dictionary. It's way too slow. You need modern tools.
Okay, what kind of tools are we talking about? What's essential?
You need specific dictionary apps. They mentioned UDIC or BlueDict as examples. These aren't just apps. They're like dictionary engines.
Engines.
Yeah. You load high-quality, massive dictionary files into them. And crucially, they integrate with your reading apps, your e-reader software, your PDF viewer. The killer feature is often called screen dictionary or something similar.
Which lets you look up a word right there on the page.
Instantly. You just tap or highlight the word, the definition pops up in a little window, and importantly, the app automatically logs that word for you. Frictionless lookup and logging.
Okay, that makes the one word per two pages rule actually feasible without breaking your reading rhythm too much.
Exactly. But the quality of the dictionary file you load is critical. They strongly warn against using learner's dictionaries.
Like the Oxford Advanced Learners. That's super common.
It is, but they argue it's often too basic. It might omit less common meanings or specialized uses of words, which you absolutely need when reading authentic, complex texts.
So you need the big guns, like the full new Oxford English Chinese or American Heritage.
Yes. You need a dictionary that covers the full range of meanings. Think about a common word like strike or port. A learner's dictionary might give you the top two or three meanings. But if you're reading a tech article about porting software or a historical text about a labor strike, you need that specific definition. A comprehensive dictionary provides that depth.
All right, we've got the theory, the why, and the tools. Now, how do you actually do it? The system interestingly starts not with reading, but with listening and speaking. Following Dr. Krashen's ideas, maybe lowering anxiety.
Yeah, exactly that. Start with sound to get some quick wins, build confidence, make it feel less daunting. So step one is a focused, pretty intense pronunciation overhaul. They budget about 2 to 3 weeks for this.
Just 2 or 3 weeks? What's the goal?
It's not about chasing that perfect accent we talked about. It's about fixing fundamental physical errors in producing sounds. They recommend specific guides, like the Precise American English Phonetic Guide.
So retraining your mouth muscles, basically. What kind of errors are we talking about?
They pinpoint common death spots for learners. Things like consistently messing up similar vowel sounds. Is it ship or sheep, leave or leave? These small differences are huge for comprehension.
Mm.
Also, problems with where you put your tongue for L sounds, or that tendency some learners have to overroll R's where they don't belong, like saying idea for idea.
Right. You have to learn the actual mechanics, tongue position, lip shape, like learning scales on a piano. If the foundation is shaky, everything built on top is compromised.
Precisely. Your brain works harder if the input sounds are off. So nail those basics first. Then you move to step two, low-speed comprehensible input. This phase lasts about 3 to 4 months.
And the recommended material here is ESLPOD, English Second Language Podcast.
Yes, ESLPOD. It gets high praise because its structure is almost perfectly designed for Krashen's I+1 idea input that's just one step beyond your current level. Challenging, but understandable.
What's so special about the format?
It's incredibly efficient. Each episode usually has, first, a dialogue read at a slow, clear speed. Then, the host explains the key vocabulary, idioms, cultural points, also slowly. Finally, they repeat the initial dialogue at normal speed.
Ah, so you get the meaning, the context, then you tackle the natural seed, triple exposure.
Exactly. And they strongly recommend using ESLPOD's structured textbooks or courses, rather than just grabbing random podcast episodes.
Why the textbook?
Because those series offer a systematic progression. They mentioned specific ones, like Introduction to the United States for Cultural Background, A Day in the Life of Jeff Lucy for Everyday Situations, and really practical business English series like Interview Questions Answered or English for Business Meetings. It provides structure and builds vocabulary logically.
Okay, makes sense. And how should you practice with this material? Just listen.
No, the key technique here is shadowing.
Repeating what you hear right as you hear it.
Yes, relentlessly. Following the recording as closely as possible, mimicking the rhythm, the intonation, without pausing the audio. The benchmark for mastering a lesson isn't just understanding it.
What is it then?
It's being able to read the normal speed transcript aloud, fluently, without looking at the text, keeping pace exactly with the recording. That means you've truly internalized the patterns.
Okay, that's a high bar. So after mastering slow speed, you hit step three, bridging to normal speed and multiple accents. They call this the hearing hell. Sounds ominous.
It's where many people get stuck. The jump from slow ESL speed, maybe 80 words per minute, to natural conversation speed, like 140, 160 words per minute, is huge.
Yeah.
And typical authentic materials like VOA News or BBC Standard English can feel like hitting a brick wall. The vocabulary is dense, the speed is high, and these all sorts of natural speech shortcuts you haven't been trained for yet.
So you need something in between, fast but maybe simpler topics. What's the recommended bridge material?
EnglishPod or EP?
EnglishPod. Okay, why is that one ideal?
Several reasons. First, the dialogues are short, often funny, and very practical everyday stuff like I have a runny nose or my computer froze.
High frequency situations.
Useful stuff.
Second, it's leveled so you can find your sweet spot. But the most important feature, it deliberately includes speakers with various non-native accents. Italian accents, Spanish, alongside American and British.
Training your ear for the real world, because you're not always talking to a BBC newsreader. Exactly. This directly tackles that pure accent myth. It forces your ear to become robust, adaptable to the diversity you'll actually encounter. It prepares you for global English, not just one idealized version.
Brilliant. Okay, so after conquering EnglishPod, there's a final step for auditory skills. Step 4, advanced accent and rhythm.
Yeah, this is for learners who are already quite advanced, using materials like American Accent Training or AAT. This isn't about basic sounds anymore. It's about the music and flow of the language.
So what does AAT focus on?
It systematically breaks down things like sentence rhythm, natural intonation patterns, liaison, how words smoothly connect, and a really crucial concept called loss of plosion.
Loss of plosion. Okay, break that down. What's plosion?
Plosion is that little puff of air you make with sounds like T, D, K, P, G, B. Think of the T in top.
Right.
In natural connected speech, especially at speed, those puffs often get reduced or disappear entirely, particularly at the end of words or in consonant clusters. Like how, what the, yeah, often sounds more like a dubia T.
Yeah.
The T isn't fully pronounced.
Or I stopped might sound like I stop.
Exactly. AT teaches you about these phenomena, like TD flapping, where T or D between vowels sounds like a quick D sound. Butter becomes butters. It stresses practicing entire sentences at normal speed to internalize this natural pronunciation. You need to train your ear to expect these shortcuts to understand native speakers easily. Okay, so once that listening and speaking foundation is solid, the main battle shifts. Phase 2, reading. And the goal here is massive. It's about moving your entire information diet, books, news, websites, everything from your native language into English originals.
Originals. And they're pretty strict about what counts as an original work, right? No shortcuts.
No shortcuts. Zero crutches. Narrowly, original work means unabridged books written by native speakers for native speakers.
Mm-hmm.
Broadly, any authentic English media. They specifically tell you to ditch simplified readers, like those graded Oxford bookworms.
Even though those seem helpful for beginners.
They argue they actually hold you back. They simplify the grammar too much, limit the vocabulary, and prevent you from developing the mental muscles needed for real text. Same goes for bilingual editions. They're a crutch.
Why so against bilingual books? Don't they help with unknown words?
They can, but they also open the door to relying on the translation, or worse, encountering translation errors.
Mm.
There's a fantastic, slightly horrifying anecdote in the source material about a Chinese translation of the Da Vinci Code.
Oh, yeah. What happened?
The English word was stripper. The translator, presumably unfamiliar with the term in that context, rendered it as something like oil paint remover female worker.
Oh, my goodness. Completely wrong context.
Completely. It just highlights that you have to engage with the original text to get the author's actual meaning, the style, the nuances. Translations, even good ones, are always an interpretation.
Point taken. Okay, so you commit to originals, but how do you pick the right one to start with? Choosing something too hard is a classic recipe for quitting.
Absolutely, critical point. They provide 3 specific data-driven metrics to help you choose scientifically and avoid those difficulty traps. Metric 1, first 10,000 non-repeated words.
Okay, what does that measure? How often words repeat?
Essentially, yes. It measures vocabulary density early in the book. How many unique words appear in the first 10,000 words? A low score means the vocabulary is simpler and repeats more often.
So good for beginners.
Perfect for beginners. Think simple books like Who Moved My Cheese? Or maybe early young adult fiction. They score low. Texts like The Da Vinci Code or dense literary fiction score very high. Avoid those at first. It gives you a clear ladder to climb. They even note how series like Harry Potter naturally get denser with each book.
Okay, that's helpful. Metric 2?
The Lexile Value or L score. This scene is even better because it goes beyond just word frequency.
What does Lexile measure?
It measures sentence complexity. Things like sentence length, clause structure, how complex the grammar is. It's a more holistic view of reading difficulty.
So what's a good starting Lexile level?
They suggest aiming for books around 570L, maybe a bit higher. This is why things like the Percy Jackson series are often great starting points. They're engaging, use authentic language, but the sentence structure is generally manageable, around 600-700L. It's not just the words, it's the architecture of the sentences.
Got it. Density and structure. What's metric 3?
Metric 3 isn't technical, but it might be the most powerful. Interest-driven selection.
Meaning, read what you love.
Absolutely. Pick something you are genuinely fascinated by. Fantasy, sci-fi, romance, history, tech manuals, whatever grabs you. Your passion for the subject is the rocket fuel that will push you through the difficult parts.
So even if a book is technically a bit hard based on the numbers?
If you're desperate to know what happens next, you'll find a way. They even say the end justifies the means. If reading something slightly controversial keeps you hooked, do it. Interest trumps difficulty.
Okay, so you've picked your book using these metrics. Now comes the hard part.
Yeah.
Sticking to the reading discipline. We have to come back to that two-page, one-word rule.
It's the heart of the method during reading. You must stick to that limit. One look up every 2 pages, or one per screen. Even when it hurts. Even when you feel lost.
Why is that discipline so critical again?
It's the safety valve. It prevents burnout. It forces you to keep the reading flow going. You accept imperfection. You accept you won't understand every word, especially at the start. You're aiming for the gist, the overall story. Remember the Harry Potter example?
Right, the reader who missed wizard and secret, but still got the main plot point.
Exactly. Context is powerful. If you keep reading, you'll figure most things out. And that strict limit forces you to rely on context.
Okay, but what about the other common frustration? I know all the words in this sentence, but I still don't get it. That's not just a vocab issue, is it?
Almost never. That's usually a usage problem or sometimes a hidden grammar issue. It happens when a familiar word is being used in a specific technical sense, an idiomatic phrase, or just a less common way.
Like port, meaning moving software, not a harbor. Or pilot for a TV show.
Precisely. Or maybe an idiom like kick the bucket. You know, kick, you know, the, you know, bucket. But together.
It means something totally different, and this is where the good dictionary comes back in.
Absolutely essential here. A basic learner's dictionary might only give you the common meaning of port or pilot. A comprehensive one, like the New Oxford or American Heritage, will list all the meanings, including the technical or specialized ones. It forces you to scroll and find the definition that actually fits the context. If it's a phrase, you need to look up the whole phrase.
Makes sense. Okay, so you finish your reading session, you've stuck to the rule, maybe looked up 10 or 20 words over 40 pages. What happens to those words now? Do you study them?
Yes, but very carefully. Vocabulary review is mandatory, but it has to be incredibly quick and focused. You review only the words you looked up that day, using the log in your electronic dictionary. But, and this is crucial, the review must take less than 5 minutes.
Under 5 minutes. For potentially 20 words. Why so fast?
To prevent it from becoming another chore, another source of burnout. The system's philosophy is that deep learning happens through repeated contextual exposure during reading. That back osmosis, not through rote review. The 5-minute review is just a quick reinforcement of the most recent lookups. It keeps them fresh for when they pop up again naturally in your reading tomorrow. Don't turn review into cramming. Okay, making that leap from being a struggling reader to someone who can comfortably read original English works. The sources describe it like crossing a great gulf. It's tough, like learning to swim or ride a bike hard at first, then suddenly it clicks.
Mm-hmm. And that initial difficulty requires a big push, right? This leads to the 7-day action plan they recommend, reading 40 pages a day for the first week. That sounds intense.
It is intense, and deliberately so. The logic is, you need to force that click. You need to internalize the skill of reading with flow before your initial motivation wears off.
Ugh, get over the hump quickly.
Exactly. If you start slow and struggle on day 2, it's easy to think this is too hard and give up. But if you push through with maximum effort for 7 days and succeed even imperfectly, the skill starts to feel natural, like balancing the bike. Once it clicks, it's much harder to lose. It breaks that demoralizing start-stop cycle.
But sustaining that kind of effort, even for a week, takes serious willpower. And willpower is notoriously flaky. Does the system offer ways to manage that?
Oh, absolutely. It includes some really sharp psychological strategies. First, big one, ditch the negative self-talk. No more beating yourself up.
So don't use slogans like don't give up or think I'm so lazy.
Right. Replace that with positive goals like persist to the end. Why? Because the sources argue that self-criticism, that internal yelling match, it actually drains your willpower.
Yeah.
It uses up precious mental energy on shame and regret instead of the task itself.
Interesting. So be kind to your mind muscle, as they call it. What's the next strategy?
Start small. Don't try to change your entire life overnight. Willpower is finite. It gets tired.
Like a muscle.
Just like a muscle. So don't decide on Monday you're going to master English, run a marathon, and go vegan. Pick one foundational habit first. Maybe something simple, like consistently going to bed by 10 p.m. Master that. Make it automatic. Then add the big challenge, like the intensive English study. Build momentum gradually.
Okay, focus. Strategy 3 deals with the archenemy, procrastination. The solution, immediate action.
Yeah, the mantra here is, it's now or never. Your brain loves excuses, loves to put things off until tomorrow or next week or after my birthday.
The fresh start fallacy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The system says any delay basically puts the task into the never pile. So the moment you think about doing your reading or your listening practice, you have to start immediately, even if it's just for 5 minutes. Break the inertia now.
Now or never. I like that. Okay, this next one feels very countercultural today. Avoid social media interference. Don't share your progress.
This is fascinating, isn't it? They strongly advise against broadcasting your learning goals or progress. No checking in on forums, no posting about your study streaks.
Why not? Doesn't sharing keep you accountable?
It seems like it should, but psychologically it backfires. When you announce your goal and get likes or encouragement, your brain gets a little hit of dopamine, a false sense of accomplishment.
Ah, so you feel good before you've done the hard work.
Precisely. And that actually reduces your internal motivation to follow through and get the real satisfaction from completing the task itself.
Yeah.
Keep your effort private. Let the results speak for themselves. Protect your intrinsic drive.
Wow. Okay. Powerful insight. Finally, let's talk time management. Creating the miracle year. Part of it is finding the time, cutting out low-value stuff like, say, hours of passive TV watching.
Right. Reclaiming those big chunks of time. But the real secret weapon they reveal, backed by examples like authors Dan Brown or Yi Shu, who are famously productive.
It's studying in the morning, like early morning, 4 a.m. to 7 a.m.
That's the golden window they advocate for the heavy lifting.
Why morning over evening? Most people think of evenings as their free time for personal projects.
It comes back to willpower. Your willpower, your executive function, your decision-making energy, it's at its peak in the morning after rest.
Fully charged battery.
Exactly. Trying to study late at night, you're fighting against a whole day's worth of decision fatigue. Your brain is biologically signaling time to wind down. It feels like pushing a boulder uphill. Efficiency plummets.
Whereas morning study uses your peak energy.
Yes, and there's another benefit. Studying early sets a productive, positive tone for the entire day. It acts as an activating effect. You've already achieved something significant before most people are even awake. It helps break that negative cycle of procrastination and failure that often haunts evening study attempts.
Okay, so we've covered input, reading systems, psychological strategies. But we need to circle back to something foundational you mentioned earlier, grammar. The dialysis method insists you can't really handle complex reading or listening without it.
Absolutely. It's not an optional extra. It's the underlying operating system. If you want to understand those long, complex sentences in serious books or articles, you need to understand how they're built. The recommended resource here, which heavily influenced the system, is Grammar Club by Swan Yuanyu.
And the key difference in Grammar Club's approach compared to traditional textbooks?
Traditional books often just give you lists of rules. Do this, don't do that. Grammar Club frames everything around the purpose of grammar, which is building clear and complex sentences. It moves logically from simple sentence structures to complex ones using clauses and conjunctions, and then to sophisticated simplified sentences using things like participles and appositives.
So it teaches grammar as a tool for construction, not just a set of rules to memorize.
Exactly. The goal is to understand how authors create meaning and nuance so you can both understand it better and eventually use it yourself. The author of Grammar Club famously said something like, "A good grammar book shouldn't have anything that needs memorizing. It should make sense structurally."
That's a radically different way to think about grammar, not as rules, but as architecture.
Yes. And once you have that solid grammatical understanding, you can truly move into the final phase, the aesthetic of usage. This is where English stops being work and starts being a source of pleasure, and cultural enrichment.
Moving beyond learning into experiencing, and the prime example they give for this is audiobooks.
Audiobooks, yes. Specifically, high-quality literary fiction read by talented actors. The sources get quite poetic here, calling it voice porn.
Uh-huh.
Okay. It's about appreciating the language on a different level. The rhythm, the musicality, the performance. It becomes a high-level form of enjoyable input, pure cultural appreciation.
But audiobooks can be tough, especially if you're still bridging that speed gap. It's easy to just zone out. How do they suggest getting started?
With the fanchild approach?
Fanchild.
Yeah, don't just pick a random classic audiobook. Find one narrated by an actor or celebrity you genuinely admire. Maybe Benedict Cumberbatch reading Sherlock, Stephen Fry doing Harry Potter. Maybe Ralph Fiennes or Amelia Fox reading something.
Ah, use your existing fandom as motivation.
Exactly. That external interest, that connection to the narrator's voice, gives you the initial push you need to stay focused, to fight through the zoning out phase until listening becomes more natural and you start appreciating the story and the language itself.
So eventually the language transforms. It's no longer this obstacle you're fighting against.
It becomes a source of pleasure, insight, connection, which really is the whole point.
Yeah.
It's achieving that native-like experience of simply using and enjoying the language.
Yeah.
Hashtag tag outro. What a deep dive that was. Okay, let's just quickly crystallize the core takeaways from the dialysis method we've explored.
Right. First, ditch that slow, inefficient accumulation. Embrace intensity. Focus your effort into a shorter, systematic period.
Second, prioritize input. Start with structured listening, like ESL-PUD, to build a foundation, then move decisively into reading original English works.
Third, adopt that strict quantitative filtering, the one word per two pages, or one per screen rule. Prioritize reading flow and volume over perfect understanding initially.
Fourth, use hardware acceleration. Good electronic dictionaries are key. And critically, shift your main study time to the morning to leverage peak willpower.
And finally, the ultimate goal. Transform English from just a subject you study into a tool you use daily and eventually a source of real cultural enjoyment.
Exactly. The promise here is that by adopting this kind of system, you're swapping years of frustratingly slow progress for potentially just months of focused, intense effort that yields tangible results.
Making English a powerful tool, not a perpetual struggle. Which leads us to that final, really interesting thought from the source creators.
Yeah, it's quite provocative. They argue that developing a truly strong reading ability in original English works the kind this method aims for, can actually, in many ways, replace the need for spending years living abroad if your main goal is just language improvement.
Wow. So reading deeply can substitute for immersion?
To a large extent, yes, for the language acquisition part. So the question they leave you with is, if you can achieve that high level of English proficiency through systematic reading, saving potentially years of time and money compared to moving overseas, what other valuable, specialized skill could you learn and master in that time you just saved?
Something to definitely ponder. Embrace the system, embrace the reading, and make English work for you. That's all the time we have for this deep dive.
See you next time.